Hello and welcome to the EI podcast. This is Ian Martin, Director of Engelsberg Ideas. I'm joined today by Andrew Ross Sorkin. Andrew is the author of 1929. It's the inside story of the greatest crash in Wall Street history. And it's the follow-up to his award-winning Too Big to Fail, a defining account of 2008. In 1929, he brings to life anew the story and characters of an epic calamity almost a century ago. When disaster struck and the markets crashed, the effects rippled through the global economy and geopolitics. What caused the bubble and why did it burst so violently? What lessons should we learn from 29? And are we heading for a rerun? All of that and more we discuss today with our guest, Andrew Ross Sorkin. Andrew Ross Sorkin, thank you for joining us. Now, you wrote one of the key texts of the great financial crisis in 2008, Too Big to Fail. And now, 1929, what prompted you?
Well, what prompted me, to be honest with you, is people used to ask me after I wrote Too Big to Fail all about 1929, how they compared, and I didn't know the answer. I really didn't. And so I started reading lots of books about 1929 just so I could pretend that I was smarter than I really was. And I became sort of obsessed with what had happened during that period, but even more obsessed with the fact that most of the books that were written about 1929, many of which, you know, came out in the 30s or in the 50s, there was one great book in the 70s, they all sort of approached it almost from an economic lens or from a, you know, a systems lens, cycles and things. I didn't find that book that I thought really brought you in the room with the characters so you could be sitting with them, you could be feeling them, and you could see it as a human story. And I ended up, by accident, being at the library at Harvard University. I was giving a lecture, and I walked in. I had extra time. I was there early. And I asked if I could look in a box of Thomas Lamont's. Thomas Lamont becomes a major character in this book. He'd run J.P. Morgan at the time. And out the box comes, and I open it up. And I think within the first three or four folders I had opened up, I realized that his secretary had been keeping transcripts of his meetings and phone calls and letters and things with Hoover and Roosevelt, and you could literally see them talking to each other. And I thought, my goodness, this, maybe I could make this work. Of course, I went back to the archivist. I explained what I wanted to do, and she told me that I would never be able to write this book because she told me that there wasn't enough material, granular kinds of material like this for all of the kinds of people and characters that I'd want. And of course, I took that as a personal challenge.
Do you think it's the case that quite a few of the previous books have been very academic? Sometimes does it take a journalist?
It might. You know, the most famous book during this period was written by Kenneth Galbraith, 1955. It's a brilliant book called The Great Crash. But it really, he was an economist, and so it came from that perspective. There's a guy named John Brooks who had worked at The New Yorker, was a great journalist. He wrote Once in Golconda, which is sort of a broader book that did it captured parts of the 20s and obviously the crash, but not in depth in that way because it really started in 1920 and sort of went, I think, to 1940 or 1945. And then there were two writers who wrote a book called The Day the Bubble Burst. Came out about 50, I think on the 50th anniversary in maybe 1979. Brits, I think, by the way. And they actually tried to do a character-driven story. So I think people have made efforts in this vein before, but I think to really get underneath it, it really required, at least for me, to get these diaries and memos and letters and notes and all sorts of material that hadn't all been unearthed yet. And the truth is, I sort of fell upon a treasure map in this process because I went to the New York Federal Reserve and asked them for the board minutes during that period. They had never been disclosed before. Oddly enough, they didn't want to disclose them to me. And actually, when they first decided that they would send me them after lots of back and forth, they sent me redacted minutes. They literally had a lawyer go through them basically 100 years later and try to redact pages. And so I finally got these minutes. But once I had the minutes, it was sort of a, as I said, it was sort of a treasure map as to where to go find all of the other material I would ultimately need.
Why do you think there was that paranoia almost? As you say, it's almost 100 years later. Is it still has this, plays this enormous role in our imagination, but particularly in the American financial imagination, there's still this sense that it would be dangerous to have these secrets out there.
The truth is, by the way, what ultimately was unredacted was not as extraordinary as you might think. You know, it's funny, if you're a board member of the Fed, and even back then and today, you are told, well, actually, maybe today you're told something different. Back then, I think they were told that everything was going to be held in strict confidence for life. I don't think that they – and I think they were trying to hold to that. Today, they actually do release the minutes. Mm-hmm. So it's a different situation.
Now, you mentioned the extraordinary personalities, and the book is full of these characters. But you begin on the 28th of October, 29, with Charles Edwin Mitchell, central character. So tell us, who is he? And why was this such an important moment?
Charlie Mitchell, to me, is one of the most misunderstood and possibly most important characters in the 1920s who has gone sort of forgotten during all this. And by the way, interestingly, he was sort of left out of most writing about this period, in part because he never had an archive or kept diaries or things. And so I ultimately had to rely on all sorts of other material to actually be able to capture that. What was happening with him. Charlie Mitchell, they called him Sunshine Charlie, ran a bank called National City. National City becomes the equivalent of Citigroup today. And he really almost invented and definitely popularized the idea of lending people money so they could buy stock for the first time. So, you know, prior to 1919, at least in America, and I think here too, it was really a moral sin, if you will, to take a loan of any sort. I mean, it was just not something you would do that was proper.
Even mortgages were uncommon.
Mortgages were uncommon. It really wasn't until General Motors in 1919 said to themselves, how are we going to sell more cars? We'll have to start loaning people money so they can afford to buy our cars. And that somehow allowed people to buy cars and made people comfortable with the idea of debt. And then you had companies like Sears Roebuck do it for appliances and sort of day-to-day items and things. And then the bankers, of course, noticed what was going on and said, we can do this too. And brokerages started to emerge on the corners of the streets everywhere. And you could walk into a brokerage. By the way, some of these brokerages were inside of hotels. I mean, they were everywhere. And you could put down a dollar and they would literally lend you $10. And this was really the first time that the ordinary investor had an opportunity to do this kind of investing in the stock market. They had seen the elites do it. This is a period of industrialization. So you have farmers all of a sudden coming to these big cities. They're seeing the elites do one thing. They never really had access. And so everybody's sort of piling in. At the same time, you had this remarkable euphoria around this sort of revolution taking place between automobiles becoming commonplace and telecommunications all of a sudden emerging, radio. I mean, RCA was the hottest company back then. They were the NVIDIA. They were a meme stock at the time. Everybody wanted to buy RCA because it was the future. And they weren't wrong. I mean, radio is the future. By the way, here we are on a podcast. So the technology, they were trending in the right direction. It was just that the economics of all of it got a little confused.
Yeah. So there he is on the 28th of October, 1929. Why is that such a key moment? We're then going to go back to some of the causes.
It's the most pivotal moment because he effectively finds out that there could be a run on his bank. He accidentally, as this crash is happening on the 28th, his traders had bought more of their own shares than they technically had enough money to buy. And he had to keep this a secret. And he didn't know what to do because he also had a big merger that was taking place. He was trying to conduct with something called the Corn Exchange Bank. And had that merger been completed, the bank would have become the largest in the world, overtaking actually the banks here in the UK for the first time. And so he had instructed them to be buying the shares, but he hadn't instructed them to buy nearly as many shares as they did. And so all of a sudden, he has to figure out how he's going to stem what could turn out to be a bank run if he doesn't solve this sort of secret problem he has. And he ultimately actually puts it on his own back, frankly, and gets a loan from J.P. Morgan in his own name and buys back the shares himself without anybody knowing.
Yeah, understood. But you then, before we get to the crash proper, mm-hmm. you track back and you paint this, I mean, it's beautifully done. You paint this picture of the lives these people led, the houses, the social ambition, really quite extraordinary, to say nothing of some of the financial practices, the pooling and all of this
stuff. Oh, goodness, there was lots of manipulation taking place.
Yeah, all sorts of chicanery, but just this, it feels almost like a civilizational peak in a way, doesn't it? That 29, that picture you paint of these magnates and the lives they lived in New York.
I opened the book, you know, after that prologue with Thomas Lamont, who's off to negotiate the reparations agreement in Paris, as it happens. And to me, it was the sort of greatest signal that, you know, finance had eclipsed politicians at that point. I mean, the U.S. government was sending the leading bankers in America to go renegotiate the U.S.'s, you know, debt deal with everybody, as opposed to sending, you know, diplomats. And it just signified sort of how the whole universe had changed. And you also then saw them on these, you know, grand boats, and you could really feel where they were living. I mean, Charlie Mitchell, by the way, for everybody who's listening and knows New York, he lived in what is now the French consulate, you know, on Fifth Avenue. It's a remarkable building. I mean, I've gone past that building a million times. I had no idea that, you know, somebody ever lived there by themselves.
But you do this in the book that just there is this sense of there being this intersection with world history, and you describe the trip and the negotiations around German reparations in the aftermath of the First World War, and that this was a grand strategic geopolitical crisis or problem that was being given to the smartest guys in the room, the cleverest people who were going to sort this out for the rest of us, which of course then goes spectacularly badly wrong.
Of course,
because of the arrogance.
Yes.
Of the same people who are doing the deal. There's this beautiful historical irony at the heart of the book.
Well, that the irony of the whole book in some ways is that you're introduced to all of these people who have such great confidence in themselves. They have such great confidence that if just a couple of the right people could be put in the right room together, anything can be solved, whether it's German reparations, whether it's ultimately the crash, which they're unable to solve, obviously, that gets away from them, or any of the other things that they're engaged in. It was this sort of remarkable period of these elites and the way that they approached everything with, frankly, a sense of arrogance about how they could do it. Yeah. And the truth is they couldn't.
As it unfolds, as the story unfolds and you build up towards the disaster, did you find yourself at key moments thinking, I can see here how this could have been different? Is there a moment where the row, particularly around the Federal Reserve, when readers get to get to that part of the book, they'll see exactly what I mean. Could, if they had run their policy differently, could the crash have been a correction
averted
rather than a disaster?
Well, so there's two pieces to this. The question that I think about a lot is, could you have averted the crash itself? And then if you couldn't have averted the crash, what could have you done afterwards? Because the truth of the matter is that the Great Depression didn't happen simply because of the crash. The crash in 1929 was the first domino. And then you see, and the book sort of walks through this because the book really goes through 1933, it's the next series of policy dominoes that really created a Great Depression, where you had 25% unemployment and 9,000 banks going out of business and all of this. So if you're sitting in the spring of 1929, what could you have done to avoid a crash? I think the answer would have had to come from the Federal Reserve or President Hoover. I have empathy for President Hoover because he shows up on the scene. He doesn't get the job till March 4th of 1929, so only a couple months to jump in front of the train. If you were the Federal Reserve, the thing you could have done, and they were trying, you could see in the diaries, they were so worried about all of this, but they were so scared that if they raised interest rates too high, they would also tip over the entire economy and then they'd get blamed for it. What I've always wondered is if they had instructed the banks not just to not make loans to speculators, which is what they did, but if they had said, the rule is 2-to-1 leverage. Yeah. Or 3-to-1 leverage. That is it. There's going to be a leverage limit that's going to be very clear. Because what you did have were people, as I said, 10-to-1, 12-to-1. Mm-hmm. And it's the leverage that lit the fire. It's a leverage that always lights the fire and is the match of every – it's the accelerant of every crisis. Mm-hmm. And when the crash actually came in October and into November of 29, it wasn't so much that the market fell by 50%, which is what it did. It's that people had lost everything because they had borrowed so much to be involved in it to begin with. So it wasn't that the stock was falling from $100 to $50. It was that you owed 10 times that because you had been leveraged. Mm. So that's what I would have done if, in retrospect.
So, yep. Because the argument at the time was that the pressure the Federal Reserve, which is, we have to remember historically, is a really new institution at that
point. They used to call it an experiment.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go back and look at some of the diaries in the early 20s, they still called it an experiment. So by the late 20s, I genuinely believe, people talk about the independence of the Fed today and whether there's political pressure. There was political pressure back then. You could tell. It wasn't that Hoover was telling them what to do, but they were so worried that if they did the wrong thing, they'd get hauled in front of Congress.
Yeah.
Or maybe the experiment would be ended.
Yeah. So then the crash hits. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still, you know, described so coherently in the book, but it's still awe-inspiring in its terror almost, isn't it? It's on such a scale.
Well, because it's not – I mean, I think at least my impression, by the way, before I began this project was that the crash happened on one day. Most people talk about Black Thursday. Some people talk about Black Tuesday. Some people talk about Black Monday. The truth is there were all of those days and more. And so the scale of it was extraordinary. I did not appreciate – you know, today we see these old black and white photographs of all of these people standing in the street around the New York Stock Exchange. It's what you usually see when people are showing images of the crash. And I never think I fully understood what they were doing there. And what were they doing there? They had thousands of people had come down there to find out what was happening to their money. I mean, literally, because they didn't know. Because part of the biggest problem was actually a technological one. The prices on the board, this is inside the New York Stock Exchange, were often 3, 4, 5, 6 hours behind the actual prices that they were trading at. And by the way, if you were at a brokerage house, even uptown in New York, let alone in London or on a boat somewhere, you could be 2 days out of date. And so many of these people, frankly, from around the country who had invested in the market were so scared they had all come down there standing in the street literally trying to get information.
It's wild. The system is broken. The system is broken down. I mean, are we – and you must be getting this question a hell of a lot because, the timing of the book, people are not going to believe you and say that
– Totally and unintentional. I had hoped to finish this book years ago. my wife will assure you we wish this was done years ago. This became an obsession and just, frankly, a great challenge to complete the way I wanted to it. With the kind of detail, and I'm happy where we got to, but the timing was not.
But
on purpose.
Well, we're glad that you did and that you persisted. But there's obviously a symmetry to doing the book in 2029. But it coming out now, you're obviously being asked the question endlessly, 10 times a day: are we headed there again, and how worried should we be now?
So the answer is yes and no. Clearly, as I was writing this, parallels did start to emerge. Look, in my day job, I'd be reporting on all sorts of things that are going on, whether they be tariffs, which of course happened in 1930, or whether euphoria around AI, euphoria around telecommunications and radio in the 1920s. The idea of democratizing finance was a phrase that was that's being used now a lot in crypto and everything else and was being used then. So there were a lot of things where I said, oh goodness, these are similar. I like to believe that while there are similarities, that we're probably closer to what looks like 1999 than 1929. There's one major distinction between then and now. We did learn something. We have rules. There are bank capital requirements today. There's an SEC. All the chicanery and manipulation and insider trading, that's illegal. There's an SEC now. So some of those things are better. The euphoria piece of it, some of the leverage in the system piece is still something I worry deeply about. And the thing that I can't figure out that might actually be the thing that could tip you into a something that's more akin to 1929 is back then there was very little government debt. In fact, in the U.S., there was a budget surplus. And one of the lessons we did learn from 1929, which, by the way, was used – that lesson was used in 2008 by Ben Bernanke, who had done his thesis, PhD thesis at Princeton about the Great Depression, is what do you do in a crisis? When you have a crisis, you bail people out and you throw money at the problem. It works. It's politically unpopular, but it works. The question is, if we do that again with all of the government debt that already exists.
And we did it with COVID.
And we did with COVID.
Certainly in Europe.
Can you break the system? Meaning, is there a moment at which the investor class or bondholders, if you will, raise their hand and say, excuse me, we like you people. We'd like to lend you money, but we're not going to do it anymore, or we're not going to do it at these prices. You're going to have to pay us an extraordinary amount because the risks that will ever be paid back have just gone up so much, you know, so much higher.
And the crunch then presumably is that governments are then – so Congress is then – you know, forget the shutdown now. Congress is then forced into really hard decisions on public
really spending. Hard decisions. You get into a real austerity kinds of situations and other very complicated things. That to me is the – black swan event that could get you to 1929. Otherwise, I think you're probably closer, as I say, to a 1999, which is to say, look, we had the internet in the early late 90s. We still have the internet. It was extraordinary. AI, similarly, I think will be a huge part of our lives. But the economics of it didn't make sense in the moment. So it's you could argue today the economics of artificial intelligence don't make sense when you have an OpenAI, for example, making, you know, $100 billion commitments to buy things, but they don't make enough money to pay for them. So you have to...
Yeah. But you tend to get this with major new technological developments, don't you? You get... I mean, it's there with the railroads. It's there in Europe. It's a kind of boom and bust. The theory being that you then... You're left at the end of the process. Once you've had the bust... You still have the infrastructure, the wiring of the system, and someone else picks up the pieces.
So this is the thing I grappled with the whole time I'm writing this book, which is to some degree you need and want speculation in the system. Every great innovation started with some speculator. You know, whoever invested in Tesla and Elon Musk in the beginning, when people thought it was an absurd idea, were speculators. That's what they were. And so the question is sort of how do you have some semblance of speculation in the system without it going overboard? You know, one of the great moments to me in this book is Winston Churchill.
I was just going to ask you. He shows up at various points.
Yeah. So Winston Churchill shows up in the United States. He actually comes to the U.S. because he needs money. And so he goes on a lecture series. And as he's traveling around the country, he gets bitten by the speculative bug too and starts buying stocks left and right. And by the way, loses his shirt like everybody else. In the crash. But what was so interesting to me is he ends up writing these fascinating letters after this period where he is defending the American system, defending the sort of optimistic nature of the U.S. capitalistic system and effectively suggesting actually that the Brits could use a little dose of this optimism and this idea that speculation, to some degree, I think he would have argued, is a feature and not a bug.
Yeah. What is it, though, what is it about American history that produces this? I mean, it's just the scale of the build-up, the crash, the after effects, which the rippling process through geopolitics and politics and ultimately it plays a major role in what happens in the 1930s and then catastrophically in the 1940s. You're left, again... One of the most effective things in this book, just with this sense of American scale, the ambition, positive, but also just the enormity of it.
Well, I think about that optimism issue that you're raising. I think it comes from the fact, and here I am a journalist who's arguably a professional skeptic. It's clearly more profitable, at least over the last 100 years, to be a professional optimist than to be a Cassandra. Just that's just math. And so it's very interesting. I look at people back in 1928, Charles Merrill, who founded Merrill Lynch, famously told his clients to get out of the market. And maybe in some ways you'd look back and say, oh, Charles Merrill was brilliant. He understood that things were gotten out of control. But then you have to think to yourself, from the beginning of 1928 to September of 1929, the stock market went up 90%. And so how do you think about that? So being a Cassandra is, it's important that we have people who are Cassandras, who are out there skeptical of things. But more often than not, and I think we've looked at this over the last 100 years, through wars and geopolitical tensions and all sorts of wild things that have happened, it's the optimist. It's the optimist that Churchill was applauding that's won the game.
Yeah. And what do you think are the lessons, the sort of psychological lessons you would draw from 29, whether it's about how people should respond if a crisis starts, about who wins in a crisis, about how to shield yourself? I mean, I suppose there are some straightforward things. Cash matters, though some people would now say if there's a coming crisis, it may be that cash is not the place to be because of what governments might do to it. I mean, all sorts of arguments. But when you are there lessons in here from 29?
Yes.
You think that's how I think people should handle it if it happens again, personally?
I think there's two lessons. One is that we're all human. And so confidence is a very tricky thing. I think overconfidence, I think we as a group of people, we always want more. We're never really holding ourselves back. We're not great at self-regulation. And so I do think a little bit of cash on the sidelines, a little bit of humility around sort of what are the possible scenarios and thinking through those risks. Even the risks that we don't understand, meaning I'll talk about the risks that I don't understand. So I think that on the front end, and from a policy-making perspective, again, trying to find this balance between creating an environment where you can have some speculation and innovation, but to the extent that there's an opportunity to have guardrails so that things don't get out of control, that's very important. Transparency is very important, by the way. A lot of the shenanigans that were going on during this period happened because there was no transparency, and we really didn't know where the leverage lie and what was really happening and how all of this was working. By the way, there were no rules back then. I mean, insider trading was illegal, which still baffles me. And then I think on the back end, the lessons are very clear. If there's a crisis, you do throw money at the problem, despite the political unpopularity of that. You flood the system with money. Hoover was trying to raise taxes at the worst possible time. You do not do that. Yeah. Hoover had decided to pursue tariffs because when he was trying to get himself elected and was so desperate to get farmers to vote for him, he promised them he would do this. So he was trying to make good on his pledge. This was a terrible idea. We are no longer on the gold standard, so we can print money. You probably need to print money despite the inflationary effects of these things. So I think there are things you can do, but they're not all easy to do.
Inside institutions or organizations, are there lessons? Because I'm taken back. I was taken back reading 1929 to Too Big to Fail, which you wrote. And a few years after that, I wrote a book in the UK called Making It Happen, which was about the British end of the crisis and a British bank, RBS, blowing up. And I remember during that, a bank chairman, one of my favorite bank chairmen, who'd survived the crisis and actually come through it because he'd anticipated a lot of the problems, saying to me something I thought rather clear and brilliant, which is that stupid questions are the best questions.
Mm-hmm.
And that very often, around a boardroom table or management table, someone will ask the stupid question and everyone will raise their eye and say, the answer is so obvious. And after 15 minutes of discussion, it emerges that most people didn't really know the answer. So that's that stupid question, you see it time and again. Why is that number so big? What happens if he can't pay us back? I mean, people now should be, that's my lesson from 29 and 2008, is that hopefully the crisis isn't now. There will be a crisis or a correction at some point in the next year to 5 years, simply because history tells us it always happens. So in the run-up to it, those in organizations can actually make a difference to their own organization just by applying that lesson.
I think asking the questions is the smartest and most important piece of it. But I think it requires a level of transparency that today I worry about. So one of the other problems that exists today that didn't exist, by the way, even in 2008, is so much of the lending that's going on in the world is not coming from the banks anymore, where they're public and there's disclosure. Because of all the regulations that we've actually implemented on the banks, a lot of the lending has moved what they call into the shadow banking system, or what are called to the private credit universe. And so I don't think we know exactly, you know, how much leverage there really is. I don't think we know how interconnected that leverage is either to the funds themselves or back to the banks. Some of the banks are providing funding to some of these funds that creates its own form of leverage. So I think there's a whole bunch of things. If I were king for the day, I would actually be going to all the – I would require private credit funds to disclose to the government, at minimum to the government, if not to the public, exactly sort of where all this leverage is, so we actually knew. That I think, is an important piece.
Final quick-fire question.
Yes.
How high would you rate the probabilities that we're in for some serious kind of correction in the market at the moment?
If serious is a 20% correction, I would say high. But that doesn't mean it has to happen today or even next year or even the year after that. There's a line in the book that gets to this idea of just, you know, sometimes the markets can, you know, remain irrational longer than you can remain liquid.
Very well put. Andrew Ross Sorkin, thank you so much for joining us. 1929, the inside story of the greatest crash in Wall Street history. Highly recommended.
Thank you so much. This was fabulous.
Great to
see you. So much fun. Thank you.